This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, my guest is the author of a new biography of President Bill Clinton titled First in His Class. Writer David Marinus is a Washington Post reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Clinton's presidential campaign. Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton declined to be interviewed for the book, although Marinus had spoken with them while he covered the presidential campaign. Several of the stories Marinus reveals in the biography have made news. One of them is about how Clinton decided against running for president in 1988, shortly after a meeting with his chief of staff, Betsy Wright. She had listed the names of women with whom he had allegedly had affairs and asked him to tell her the truth about each one and to determine who might make trouble for the campaign. After hearing his answer, she advised him not to run.
Well, they met about 2 days before Clinton was about to announce to run for president in 1988. And the context of that meeting was that only a few months earlier, Gary Hart had dropped out of the race, primarily because of problems with infidelity or alleged infidelity on his part. And Betsy Wright was Clinton's longstanding chief of staff. There had been rumors in Washington and around Little Rock about Clinton's own sex life. And the two of them met at Betsy Wright's house to go over a list of women who might be problematic for Clinton. The part that's interesting to me is not so much the women involved as what it said about Clinton and his feeling perhaps of invulnerability even after Gary Hart had gone through a similar episode. There was a sense that Clinton was ready to run up to the last minute, up to that meeting when they went over the list.
Why did Betsy Wright advise him not to run?
Well, she advised him not to run because she thought that he would have trouble. I think it's as simple as that on that issue. I mean, it was a
trouble with women coming forward saying
yes,
they'd had affairs.
Perhaps. And whether there were women who really did or didn't, she wasn't certain about, but she thought it would be troublesome.
Now, she told you, I believe, in an interview for this book, that she had constantly dealt with the issue of Clinton having affairs during the 80s when she worked for him in the governor's office. What did she tell you?
She told me I had several interviews with Betsy Wright. And I don't mind talking about this, but I want to point out that it's about four paragraphs in a 500-page book. And it's not what the book is really about, except as a sense of trying to convey one of Clinton's characteristics. In any case, she told me in one of those interviews that over the years she had a feeling that state troopers were helping Clinton get women.
It seems to me you're not real interested in talking about this particular section of Clinton's life or of your book.
I'm willing to talk about it. I just don't like to focus on it to the exclusion of all else because I chose purposely in this book not to focus on it too much.
Tell me why. I mean, tell me, like in writing a biography of a president while he's still in office, what is appropriate and what is inappropriate in terms of the man's sexual life and rumors about him sexually? Tell me how you wanted to handle this.
Well, I wanted to study his personality. And he is a man of enormous appetites. I think that sex is one part of his enormous appetite. And I wanted to study that and see where it came from. And I think in the book you get a clear sense of him at an early age of having that appetite. I didn't want to, because all these people are still alive, I didn't want to deal with every woman that he'd been involved with over the years. Nor did it, that would have taken me a long time probably to track all of them down. And that was not the focus of what I wanted this book to be about. I was trying to write a book about why Clinton, out of all the people of our generation, was the first to become president. And I wanted to write a book that explored the tests of our generation through Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Just one more question on this. Do you think it should matter whether he had affairs or not?
That's for everyone else to decide on their own. I wasn't willing, nor do I want to make that judgment. I think it should matter when those affairs might conflict with his public duties. And I think that in 1987, when he was about to run for president, the fact that he came so close right after Gary Hart had dropped out showed a sense of him thinking that he was invulnerable or that he could cover up anything. And I think that was somewhat dangerous.
You spend a lot of time in your biography of President Clinton on the draft, which you see, I think, as a turning point in his life, a turning point in defining his future. What were some of the internal conflicts you think he was going through when he was trying to figure out what course he should take when he wanted to complete his time at Oxford and he knew that he'd be called to serve?
I think that Vietnam and the draft are a major test of all young men in his generation, my generation. And I spend six chapters writing about, weaving it in and out of six chapters. Clinton faced several contradictions. He came from a part of the country, the South, where most of his high school friends went into the service. Four of his high school friends were killed in Vietnam. He felt a lot of pressure from home to go to Vietnam. When he was at Oxford, he wanted to stay there, obviously. He was with a cohort of other Rhodes Scholars who were against the war. He was against the war and had been since he worked for Senator Fulbright on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in his college days at Georgetown. And also he had the pressure of knowing that he wanted a life in public service, in politics. So any decision he made, he realized, would come back to him later. So he was faced with sort of a three-way pressure that was very difficult for him. And he went through a lot of agony. Some of it might have been hyperbolic in his letters to friends, but I think that he really was struggling to find a way through it. Now, Clinton is a remarkably protean character who's always searching for a way to get through trouble. And in fact, he found a way to make it look like he wanted to serve when in fact he didn't. But that came back to haunt him later.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he signed up for an ROTC program at the University of Arkansas Law School. He really didn't want to go there.
He didn't want to go to the University of Arkansas Law School.
I don't think he wanted to go to the University of Arkansas Law School at all. He would have been happy to go to Yale Law School, which he later did. And he didn't want to be in the ROTC program. But on the other hand, he had been drafted, and if he had not signed up for that, he would have been inducted into the military. He was about to face an induction on July 28th, 1969, when he made the deal with the ROTC at Arkansas to go there. Now, after he made the deal, he cut a separate deal with the colonel who ran the ROTC program to let him go back to Oxford for a while. And as soon as he went back to Oxford, the Nixon administration changed its policy on Vietnam, made it possible for graduate students to serve out a whole year in school, even if they were drafted. And the Vietnamization process was starting. They stopped inducting troops in the first three months that Clinton was back. And they were about to go to a lottery system. So everything made it clear to Clinton and to his friends that they would be safe for a while. And at that point, he withdrew his deferment and took his chances on the lottery and got a lucky number. So he got out of everything.
So you say that the essential question in this part of his life is not so much what he did as why he did it. Was he driven by guilt and honor, or was this a draft-wise young man playing every angle?
That's what I say in the book, and I also say that it looked like he was playing every angle, but there was an honest agony involved in it, too. I'm not harshly down on one side. I'm a little more harsh about how he handled it later when it is clear that he was deceptive about what happened to him. As he was about to run for president in 1992, actually in late 91, in an interview with a colleague of mine at the Washington Post, he said that he did not get drafted when he was at Oxford. And in fact, there are documents and letters in my book which show it was clear that he did receive the draft notice.
So what's the significance of this chapter in Bill Clinton's life in your reading of Bill Clinton as a man?
Well, I think it's one more example that shows the internal conflict between ambition and idealism that was always there with Bill Clinton and the Faustian bargains that he had to make along the way. He was a man who always wanted to be president. And so every decision he made had to be weighed in that balance. And sometimes it affected him adversely. I think that the main reason Clinton was different from the millions of other young men who did similar things to avoid the draft in one way or another during that era is that he had to deal with it for the rest of his life, where there, so many other people could forget about it. But because he wanted to go into public service, the manipulation that he went through haunted him.
And just to put this into more context, what about his friends who were at Oxford with him?
Yeah, I think that's an important context. There were 31 of the 32 Rhodes Scholars that year went to Oxford. The 32nd, a man named Jack Pratt, felt guilty about the fact that his draft board was about to give him a deferment. So he enlisted in the military right away. He didn't want to have any special privileges. Now, of the other 31, two were actually in the military from the military academy, so they don't count in that sense. Of the others, more than half of them got deferments that year, that first year at Oxford, after the federal government had eliminated graduate school deferments. They got those deferments just off the blessing of their local draft boards, who were so proud to have them as Rhodes Scholars. And so in that sense, Bill Clinton's special treatment, quote-unquote, was indeed special compared to working-class kids around the country who had absolutely no choice. It was not special in comparison to the other Rhodes Scholars. Many of those Rhodes Scholars got off for various so-called ailments, bum knees, like Strobe Talbot, now the Deputy Secretary of State, had a bum knee from his prep school days, but he could still play squash. Others had migraine headaches or whatever and still were great tennis players and swimmers. Everybody got out in one way or another who wanted to.
I think one theme that runs through your biography of Bill Clinton is that there seem to be two different sides to his personality. What are those two sides?
One side is manipulative and deceptive and fueled by a desire to make it, deep ambition. There's a scene where his first campaign in Arkansas, he's working for a judge named Judge Holder, who was running for governor, and David Pryor, then a young congressman, bumped into Bill Clinton for the first time. And after their meeting, he turned to his wife and said, "He's on fire, that boy's on fire." And that Bill Clinton would do just about, well, not anything, but did a shade the truth, do several questionable things to get where he wanted to go. The other Bill Clinton is tireless, empathetic, optimistic, and a great friend to people. And it's the classic battle between darkness and light. Clinton even talks about it in one part of the book. After he was defeated in 1980, he went up to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville to talk to a political science class, and he talked about how in most leaders there is that constant struggle between darkness and light. And in Clinton's case, I'm not willing to say that either side has prevailed. It's still going on.
Journalist David Marinus is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Marinus is my guest. He's the author of a new biography of Bill Clinton called First in His Class. What's your assessment of him as president so far?
Well, I say that my book ends the day he announced for president, but everything that's happened since is in the book. I think that there are recurring themes in his life that are evident in him as president. He achieves things, but he's also confounding. I think that I wouldn't count him out yet, but he's had, the troubles he's had do not surprise me. I think that in terms of his attempts to appease all sides, starting with the gays in the military issue, which reminded me so much of a lot of incidents in his past, where he was looking for a middle ground, couldn't find it, and in essence, both sides came out mad at him.
Can you give us an example of one of those instances?
From his past?
Yeah.
Sure. In his first term again as governor, he wanted to rebuild the road system there. It was pretty bad shape because there were roads where school buses couldn't even get to the schools in rural Arkansas. So he decided to advance a major roads program. And it would be taxed largely on the backs of the major trucking interests in the state and the poultry interests, who were the major truckers. Now, poultry is very powerful in Arkansas. They formed a coalition against him. The highway lobby, on the other hand, loved his program at first. Clinton at first supported the highway lobby, then he changed his mind and supported the trucking lobby's proposal. and both sides thought that he was double-crossing them. They both got mad at him. It turned into a disaster, and both sides eventually worked to defeat Clinton.
Your biography is of a current president, and I think it must be very hard to write a biography of a man who's in the White House. I think when somebody leaves, then the president himself and others around him become more circumspect, a little more willing to talk. But while he's in, particularly if he's considering a second term, it's, I'm sure, quite difficult to get people to really level with you. So tell us a little bit about what you were up against in trying to write this book.
I think you're right. It's very rare for a biography of this sort to be written while someone's president. I'm not sure it's been attempted to this degree before. And I knew it would be difficult. I had covered Clinton during the campaign, so I knew scores, if not hundreds, of people whose lives had intersected with his over his life, and many of them trusted me. Clinton and Hillary were sort of on record as saying that I was a fair reporter, but as soon as I started a biography, Clinton in particular was not happy about it because he is a political animal and he would be running for re-election, and he understood the calculation of having a book about his past coming out while he was in office would be a touchy one. So he did not cooperate. On the other hand, he did not tell his friends not to talk to me, and I talked to hundreds of his friends, 400 people in all. The only instance of uncooperation I got in that sense was three or four of the people connected to Hillary Rodham Clinton called the White House and were told not to talk to me. Other than that, I think that I did about as well as someone could do in those situations. I got a lot of his letters from his past, from past girlfriends and from relatives back in Arkansas. They were very important to me. Documents were important to me wherever I could get them, because, of course, people's memories are always questionable. And I'm sure that it's a funny thing about Clinton that even his closest friends, while they want to present the best side of him, they see the complications in him as well. And so many of them were willing to talk to me about that at all levels of his life.
What do you think of a biography of a president in office should be?
Well, I wanted it to be a fair biography that would explain to people why Clinton is doing what he's doing today so that they might understand him better. That was my larger purpose in that sense.
Is there territory you intentionally stayed away from?
I didn't intentionally stay away from any territory. There were two parts of the book that I spent less time on for practical reasons, or one for practical reasons and one for probably my own philosophy, which we've talked about a little bit. For practical reasons, I didn't make it a Whitewater book. You could write a whole book about Whitewater, and someone is doing it. And that was not what I wanted this book to be. So I wanted to explain Clinton in a way that when the Whitewater stuff happens, however it does, people have an understanding of the man. The other section that I was cautious about was sex, because it's just something that I'm personally not that interested in, except as it relates to his political decisions.
You know, I guess I'm interested in hearing how Bill Clinton appeared differently to you when you were writing about him as a candidate than he does now that you've had this chance to write a 500-page biography of him.
Well, it has more to do with the process of covering a campaign than it does with Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, there's so much pressure during a campaign to come up with something new or just to keep writing stories, you know, every day or whatever, and to compare him with the other candidates and so on. And for instance, all of the stories about Clinton in the draft that were written during the campaign, I would not denigrate any of them. I think they were important and revealing, but none of them really put him into the context of that time. And that's what I wanted so badly to do in this book, and that's why I spent so much time on it. I mean, I am 3 years younger than Bill Clinton. I'm part of that generation. I know how important Vietnam and the draft were to all of us, and I know how many of my friends and everyone's friends did various things, from going to Vietnam, serving there, getting killed, getting out, for all of these reasons. It was a very difficult, complicated time. And it infuriated me that it could be so stereotyped in reduced into one dimension during a campaign. And so that's what I tried to get past in the book.
You know, it's interesting. Most of the Republicans at last night's New Hampshire fundraising dinner, people who have thrown their hats into the ring, they're the older generation again.
Some of them are, yeah. Phil Graham was got 5 deferments from the draft. That'll be a question. I think that Bill Weld, who is Clinton's generation, and in fact attended the same college at Oxford as Bill 2 years earlier, University College, dealt with the draft in a way that he might not want to have come back to haunt him either. But you're right, Bob Dole is, if he's elected, would be, what, the oldest president in American history before his term was out, older than Reagan. So there is a sense, I think, if I know what you're getting at here, that Clinton was the first baby boom president, but maybe the baby boomers weren't ready for one of their own.
The press has mostly picked up on stories relating to Clinton's sex life. I'm wondering if you think that there are any stories in the book that you feel are most revealing about the president.
I hope that every chapter of the book is revealing. I think that there are recurrent themes in Clinton's life that on a larger scale, I think, are the most important. You can see it in almost any part of his life. I mean, I like the story of when he was at Georgetown. And his first 2 years there, he was elected president of the freshman and sophomore classes. This kid sort of coming out of nowhere in Arkansas and glad handing his way to the presidency both years. And then in his junior year, he decided to run for student council president which would be in his senior year. And his peers got sick of him. They thought he was too closely tied to the Jesuit administration at Georgetown. There was a nascent rebellious mood among the students there that Clinton totally failed to pick up on. He thought he could just handshake and work harder and get elected. And the fellow who defeated him, I sort of compare in a sense to Newt Gingrich in that he had tapped into sort of a public sentiment, which was rebellious, but this guy, Terry Modlin, who was the other candidate, was kind of more to the right of Clinton, as Gingrich is in a sense. So I just saw that as such a remarkable parallel to things that happened later in Clinton's life. And there are a lot of stories like that in the book that I think sort of resonate.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
David Marinus wrote the new biography of Bill Clinton called First in His Class. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.